Hello and welcome to another edition of the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. This week, I'm absolutely fantastic panel of guests, and we're going to be talking about the subjects of obsolescence and counterfeiting and why businesses should be getting involved in this conversation and should understand why this is so important to organizations going forward. So without any further ado, I'm going to let them introduce themselves. So we'll start with Mike.
Hi, I'm Mike Schwarm. Nice to be here. My background, I'm an engineer, ended up working for mostly manufacturers my entire career, BAE Systems, DRS Technologies before it was Leonardo DRS, Cobham Advanced Electronic Solutions, and a few others. Switched over a few years ago, and I'm working for a company, Certify Holdings. SMT Corp is one of the companies that is part of Certify Holdings, and we do anti-counterfeiting. So we'll go out and once obsolescence becomes a major issue and you have no other options and you have to go into the open market, source parts without traceability, we'll go out, find those parts, bring them, test them, make sure that they're authentic and are what they say they are, quality and all that.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Mark.
Yeah, good morning, everyone. I'm really pleased to be here. Mark Broadhead, I'm the Business Development Director for Certify Holdings and SMT Corp. So I work with Mike. And I've been with the business various acquisitions for 27 years, mostly in franchise electronic component distribution. And more recently in the open market environment that Mike has just described. So I'm kind of the new guy to obsolescence and counterfeit. Been in this space for the last couple of years, and yes, fascinating topic. Really enjoy it.
Well, I think I'm the new guy now. I'm the Mr. Vice here because I'm very much the newest person in the room to this. But I'm absolutely fascinated about what we're going to be talking about, and so thank you, Manu. Hi.
Hi. I'm Manu Grundy, and I'm the CTO for IOM UK, and IOM is the Institute for Obsolescence Management. I've also got an engineering background and worked in various roles in automotive, marketing and technical, and now have been with IOM for nearly 2 years and delighted to be talking about obsolescence today. Thank you.
Brilliant. Thank you, Manu. I really appreciate your time here as part of your role within the Institute. So thank you. And I have to admit, I didn't even know there was an International Institute of Obsolescence Management until a couple of months ago. So I'm sure there will be a lot that you have to explain to our listeners to help them to come along on the journey with us today. John. Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, thank you. So I'm John Dyson. I'm with Winslow Adaptics. I'm on the business development side. So we design, manufacture, remanufacture obsolescence solutions for mechanical, small mechanical, electronic, and in particular semiconductor obsolescence. Also, the other side of my job, the other side of me, is actually I'm the vice chair for IOM UK and Ireland and on the board for IOM International.
Brilliant. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And John and I met at a JOSCAR event last year, and it was John that got me thinking about obsolescence management. So it's entirely 100% his fault that we're all here today. And finally, Alex. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I'm definitely here as well because of John. So I'm Alex Johnston-Morfoss. I'm the founder and director of Simply DD. So a bit of background first. I'm a nuclear engineer and I've always wanted to be in the sector. I'm very passionate about it. And I started my career on new build projects in the UK. And then I joined the aging and obsolescence CNI team, control instrumentation team, working on the existing fleet of power stations in the UK. So I guess that's why I'm here today, to give you a bit of insights on the nuclear industry side. And about Simply BD, so I started the business a couple of years ago, and we support businesses across the nuclear industry with growth. And in practice, that means we help them to understand the market, identify opportunities, and connect with key decision makers and buyers. So whether your business that's already in nuclear or not, we can identify market fit, and that's across decommissioning, fusion, existing generation, and also new build. So you will have heard about small modular reactors a lot at the moment. Yeah, and I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
That's great to have you. Thank you very much. So obsolescence then, I mean, what is obsolescence? How do we break that down into something that our listeners can understand if it's not something that they've come across before? And why do organisations need to be aware of it and be prepared for it? Who'd like to kick us off on that? Maybe Manu as the senior person here from ION.
Fantastic. Yeah, sure. I mean, in its true sense, obsolescence is when a part or an item is no longer available from its original source. So that can be a part, a software, a certain skill that you can't get hold of anymore. So it can be any technology changes that trigger that. It can be a software update. And I'm sure we'll go into more examples in a bit. But this poses a real risk for any company, anybody out there, for their continuity of supply, for the supply chain, for counterfeiting risk, for, I guess, their brand and reputation if you can't supply a part anymore. And there are stuff you need to do to protect yourself against it.
How would you align the term obsolescence with the term that we use a lot in the IT world when we're talking about systems as legacy?
I would probably say legacy is anything that happened in the past, but obsolescence is something that happens and you can't stop it. And you can just prepare for it in a certain matter, if that makes sense. So it's something that's triggered by certain, I guess, events in the market, technology advances like Microsoft bringing out a new software and not supporting Windows 10 anymore. Or it's geopolitical triggers such as the war in Ukraine, the Brexit, our loved top and hated topic, the Suez Canal. There are so many things that trigger obsolescence, and that's aside from the planned obsolescence that some company might develop or build into their products.
Right. So obsolescence isn't necessarily time bound. It can be caused by a whole range of geopolitical, financial, and manufacturing events. Even potentially an organization going out of business unexpectedly.
I mean, a way that I think about it, obsolescence, just to use an example that kind of probably ties together the legacy and the obsolescence discussion, is a particularly hard problem in the defense industry, because you have systems that have been deployed that are still fielded that were made in the 1960s, right? So systems that have been out there for 30, 40, 50 plus years. And it's not just defense. I mean, the nuclear energy actually has this problem as well. I mean, you have the plant in Oswego, New York, has been in operation since the 60s as well. So you have these long in the tooth systems, but the average life of an electronic component, for example, is 4 to 7 years, right? So you have a major disparity between the length of how long these systems have been deployed and how long an active part is actually out there and available. So that to me is the fundamental problem of obsolescence, or what causes obsolescence.
So that's a major issue with your area in nuclear as well then, Alex, because, I mean, how long is a nuclear reactor in service for? You know, decades.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So, to give you an idea of scales, we've got over 400 reactors in operation at the moment and 65 under construction. And as of 2023, the average age of the international fleet was 31 years. So we've got that global trend of aging nuclear fleet, and obviously in the UK, they're mostly on the old side. And when they were designed for 40 years, but obviously it's recognized now as a reliable, low carbon and relatively cheap electricity source. So most operators have already extended that lifespan, and often up to 60 to 80 years. So obsolescence is definitely an issue there. And it's very costly to do design changes to have new components in. So they're trying really hard not to change anything, but obviously they have to, especially with digital products that they have to introduce.
Actually, it puts me in mind in where I live up in the northeast with the Newcastle Metro, the metro trains that are running on the Newcastle Metro are something like 40 odd years old now, and are regularly literally falling apart on the tracks as they run along. And increasingly the operators are saying they're desperate to get their new fleet commissioned and into use because they can no longer even maintain them because the parts are no longer available. They're cannibalizing their own fleet in order to keep the what trains they've got on the tracks. So it actually happens. It's not just a business to business thing. This is something that can affect us in all sorts of society, isn't it, John?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think rail, it's good that you've touched on that, because it's a good example of another sector that really suffers from this badly. And the Newcastle Metro is by no means the only one that's in that kind of situation. I think it's, you know, there's a difference between, there's almost for me, the difference between the kind of consumer products and what we have with things like our phones, smartphones and so on, versus the things like the rail industry is this time that it has to live for. You know, that to live for sort of 30, 40 years is perfectly normal. And do you know what is the right thing for it to do? It's what we should all be asking for. But it's how do you maintain that infrastructure, that supply chain of parts? You know, why does electronics in particular, because that's my sort of field of expertise, why does electronics have to change so much?
You know, we've almost become like a throwaway consumer society, haven't we? You know, nobody fixes a TV or a washing machine anymore. It breaks down, you trash it, take it down to the tip, and you get a new one.
I think there's a movement to steer away from that kind of world. I think we all got caught up in that shiny sort of new tech product world, and I think now we expect a longer life cycle. I certainly expect a longer life cycle. I don't, you know, if you buy the cheapest, maybe that's what's going to happen to you, you know, and maybe there is a call for consumer products to sort of increase their longevity, their life cycle. But certainly for me, but I think in going back to the rail industry, these kind of industries, it's how do we set up a system? And this is what we try and do within the sort of supply chain world of obsolescent solutions, is how can we set up a system whereby we can keep the manufacture going, even if it's not necessarily exactly the same. So if somebody's gone bust, which I think somebody mentioned, somebody going into administration, could we then take that IP? Could we buy that IP? Could we license that IP? So is there some official way that we can actually continue making the cards, the components, that, you know, obviously at a price that people will actually need to keep the metro going so you can get to work on time?
So the other thing I kind of wanted to also just tag on what John was saying as well, as it relates to, you know, when you start getting into supply chain and how to kind of manage longevity of components and products that go into other systems. You know, John had mentioned something about third party manufacturing, licensed manufacturing, that kind of stuff. That, in addition to like having to go into the open market to find problems, that also poses a risk, right? Because I don't know if you remember, well, obviously you remember, several months ago, there were these legacy, to use your term, Apollo pagers, two-way pagers, right? And those were, the supply chain was compromised in those because they ended up becoming third-party licensed manufactured products. So once you lose control as the manufacturer of a product, there's other things that could affect your supply chain security beyond just having something in the open market without traceability. Third-party licensed manufacturing, clone factories in China, blah, 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 right? So there's lots of other things you need to be aware of as you're starting to look at your supply chain. So, you know, for Manu and John, when you're thinking about, I mean, they're the experts in obsolescence, and the problem of obsolescence is massive. I mean, in terms of like, how do you plan for that when you have these large legacy, long cycle systems that have been out in the field? And it's not just an open market problem. It's really a supply chain problem.
Right. So, Mark, how do you manage that when it comes to things like operational continuity, but also balancing against the need for innovation?
Well, I think it all starts for me back at that design cycle. So when you're, you know, designing a product or solution from the outset, taking into consideration, you know, obsolescence, managing the obsolescence of that platform that you're working on. And as Mike and as others have said, you know, these platforms are in service for 20, 30 plus years in many cases. So really taking care of that design in stage to consider obsolescence, and the components and the parts and the products that you're using as part of that design really are crucial to get ahead of that and not fall victim to things that are out of your control that we've spoken about.
Brilliant. I mean, John, you, like us, you've been a winner of the JOSCAR Innovation Award. So I'm sure you've got something there to talk about when it comes to the balancing of innovative capabilities versus obsolescence.
Yeah, obviously. I think for me, you know, what I was talking about then was really this idea about the new shiny thing. Which is what we're all been pursuing, whether we want to or not. We're kind of drawn along by that. And what I was offering, what Winslow Adaptics were offering was this opportunity to maybe, instead of using the latest shiny thing, actually keeping the old stuff going for longer and supporting that through other technologies, adapter based technologies that allow you to sort of to use the latest stuff in the old PCBs. And that's all I did, really. I presented that in a way that I think people could understand. Because, you know, we talk about, I go down the pub and people say, what do you do for a living? You know, and they say, I say obsolescence management. And they're like, what? You know, you can see the blood drain out of their faces when actually, really, it's actually quite exciting. It's fundamentally part of everything that we see and use every day in our working lives. And it was just a great opportunity for me to sort of explain what we do in a kind of a more approachable, more sort of understandable way.
Yeah, we were back in to come away for a short break actually the other day, and we had to go through the usual rigmarole of making sure we had every charger for every device, because we've got a previous generation Kindle, for example, that has the older USB-C charger. We've got an iPhone that requires an Apple charger. We've got, and it just it's interesting that I've still got this little box of about six different types of chargers just to make sure that we can keep our devices going.
Yeah,
That's just a tiny thing. Obviously, you know, if you multiply that up across all sectors and all industries, that's got to be a major challenge.
I think it is. It's not in my area, but you know, I have that same problem. I have that same collection of chargers, and the USB-C obviously has come along to try and sort of be a universal charger for everybody. But obviously, in the process of adopting that, we've got to get rid of all the other chargers that we've got. You know, so it's a double-edged sword, that one, I think, really. But it's a consumer problem, isn't it?
I think it's a commercial as much as it is an obsolescence, I guess, decision, because if we're talking consumer products, there is something that businesses want to build in as being unique, being the technology, the advancement, all that kind of stuff. And that doesn't always go hand in hand with obsolescence and sustainability. And I guess there is a real challenge out there for us as the Institute, as well as for the government, to put things in place that these things are linked up, either because of it being a natural link in a good reputation, or forced by legislation and a beneficial, I guess, way forward to protect the environment and therefore managing obsolescence as part of the sustainability initiative.
So it feels to me then that this is a significant area of risk for organisations.
Definitely. You know, I think if we can just go back to the kind of COVID era, you know, that's when we kind of were alerted by the dangers of this. So there was the emergence of diminished supply as well as obsolescence. So it was kind of like temporary obsolescence, where the supply chain broke down because you couldn't, for one reason or another, you couldn't get the components that you needed. And I think that's, you know, there's been something that's come out of that manufacturers had lost sight through the tiers of their supply chain of where the potential product sort of pitfalls were. And I think lessons have been learned that big manufacturing organizations are looking down that supply chain. They're saying, look, I need to know your plans. If something like this happens again, what are your contingency plans for keeping my semiconductors coming along in for my products? Which is, yeah, that's that's the thing.
Right, well, as a response to exactly that point, the COVID supply chain breakdown, companies went out and they massively bought inventory so that they could try and avoid that. But now you see the inverse happening, because we go in and we talk to companies and they're like trying to get rid of this excess inventory that they built up because they don't have any programs for it. So likely, you know, if I put my business hat on, that's going to flip back, you know. So you went from this just in time to just in case production model. And the answer is probably somewhere in between, but you're kind of concerned now that it flips back to just in time and then we're back in the same boat, right? The next time the Suez Canal gets shut down because a boat gets stuck, or, you know, the supply chain breaks down because there's some kind of like, you know, tariff war or whatever, you know, and any of those things could cause that to happen again.
Yeah, definitely.
That's a knock-on effect. I mean, we're still feeling that 4 years down the line in the supply chain of that shockwave that happened as a result of COVID. So again, that what we were discussing there, Manu, about the sort of geopolitical and the wider, you know, impact. We certainly here in the UK, I know across all sorts of industries, had been doing pandemic planning, but we'd been planning for the wrong type of pandemic. So we've got to, how many, I mean, I'm trying to think now, when I'm reviewing risk registers for organizations, I mean, I've spent a lot of time pushing to get security risk onto corporate risk registers. How much does obsolescence management feature on corporate risk?
I mean, I'm not sure whether that is mentioned in there, but realistically, if we talk about if obsolescence management is done proactively and strategically, that should span across the entire business, really, from your designs, your supply chain, onto, I guess, end-of-life management. It should really be the parallel stream to everything to support your business, and it then feeds into your procurement, your supply chain, that benefits on other scenarios when we come to legislation or compliance with any, like if we're talking REACH or PFAS or anything that will happen, your supply chain then benefits from managing it in, like, know your supply chain, know where your risks are, know where your critical items are, know where your trigger points are, have a plan, I guess is the message here. Don't just go into it blind and don't react. Don't be on the back foot for everything you do. Yes, there is a reactive side to obsolescence management because you can't plan for everything, but it is being proactive and having an what we call OMP, obsolescence management plan, in place.
So we've been, over the last few years, adopting new security methodologies for assurance here in the UK, which, although varying slightly from different sectors, is broadly called secure by design. Feels very much what we're talking about here is obsolescent management by design, getting that conversation about obsolescent management at the start of the process instead of once something has gone obsolescent and then having to manage it retrospectively.
Yeah, so this is something that I really believe in, and I've been sort of preaching through some of the presentations I've done recently that actually take it to the design process, because the standard, if you like, standard, actually the gold standard at the moment really is to have this obsolescence management plan, the proactive plan. But actually, if you take it that step back and you take it to the designers and you design in alternatives, you know, there's going to be supply chain disruptions of sorts. There's going to be design changes, businesses joining together to make new businesses and so on. So things are going to change. And if you can design in alternatives, if you can put sort of modular design, for instance, into place where you've got this option in the future, no guarantees, but an option that you can perhaps unplug something, plug something else in, and off you go with the latest technology. Mm. And that's really important that the designers are part of that process. Which is, you know, one of the things we're really trying to spread the word, get everybody involved in this obsolescence management process.
And I don't think it's just the designers, though. If we think of the supply chain, I think has got a role to play here. So if we think of the designer decides which parts they're selecting, and some companies might have a list of preferred parts, but that loop to the procurement and the supply chain to say, actually, can I just check with you? are these parts in short supply? Are they there? Have you had any notifications from your supply chain? That tying back in at the design process before the design is actually fixed, I think is one step that companies are advised to check, just to get rid of those obsolete parts in products that haven't even reached the market yet.
I think that's, you know, obviously important in the design cycle, the design for obsolescence, and exactly what Manu and John were saying. I just don't know how you do that 100%. I mean, you can't do it 100%, especially when you've got systems that have obsolete parts by the time they're even fielded, right? Again, my sector, defense, you have that problem, right? A Joint Strike Fighter, by the time it's fielded, you know, not half the parts, but a good part of the parts are already obsolete. So how do you deal with that problem up front? It's, I mean, this is why Manu and John and what they do is so important, because it's fundamentally, to me, an unsolvable problem. We actually were talking to, Mark and I were talking to the UK MOD. We were presenting, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago. And one of the guys actually asked things. Well, why don't we just use commercially available parts, or like, or part, everything that's, you know, been qualified under a certain standard? And it's like, because you're designing modern systems, right? You're always pushing the edge of the envelope. So to some degree, you're kind of pushed out of, you know, the good idea part of it, which is, John, let's modularize everything to things that are highly customized and highly, you know, integrated for a specific function. So everything kind of, from my mind, kind of works against what you're trying to do, right? You're basically always pushing the edge to have modern, effective systems. And so you're almost pushing yourself out of that risk management, obsolescence management part of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, is it possible to push that envelope and still manage obsolescence?
Obviously it is. And I'm not saying, I said at the time, you know, there's no guarantees in building in modularity, but I think what's really, really important is that we don't say, because we can't solve it 100%, we'll just give up, you know, we'll just carry on the way we're doing, because that's the risk. And that's what happens, you know, because obviously it's cheaper not to bear it into consideration. So I really think it's important that we do aim for something, even if we know deep down we won't achieve 100%. I know I never have.
I'd like to come back to something that kind of was mentioned in passing, but which I think is probably equally important, because so far we've very much been talking about tangible things like product. But, and I think it might be Manu that mentioned skills.
Yeah, so it can be anything from programming skills that certain engineers have on the software that sits on a legacy or an old system that you've got in place. What happens if that person retires? Have you got a plan for this? You might not need that skill very often, but what happens if something breaks in 5 years' time? Have you ensured that you have got someone who can repair that system? Otherwise, you need to scrap the entire train, for that example. That's what we're talking about. People skills is as much as something that needs to be managed, and it's not as tangible as it is when you talk about technology or software or parts.
And I think that's something that we've seen over the years in banking, for example, where they do have a lot of banking systems that have been written in, if you like, legacy languages. You know, the programming languages have moved on, and then they're further down the line, they're struggling to find people who understand how to maintain and manage those systems, because those skills have been lost.
Definitely.
You can read a piece of papyrus from 3,000 years ago, but you'd struggle to open a Word document that was created on a Windows XP system.
I think, you know, I look to the industry that I've been in, which is electronics, and there's a huge skills gap coming. There's a huge skills gap on the horizon, because many of the people, unfortunately, in the industry, I represent them. As a sort of grey-haired old white man, and we need to have more young people coming in particular. But what we've got is this kind of gap in the middle. So we've got now an interest. We've got the STEM programs going on. We've got lots of people coming into engineering, and I think there's a realization that it's a great career now. But there's this hole in the middle for the last sort of 20, 30 years, where people have been just running businesses down, moving manufacturing abroad, where we just don't have those skills at all. And when my sort of generation retire, what we're going to do.
That's really interesting, John, because that's exactly the challenge we've got in the security world as well. And like you, as a middle-aged white man, I am still considered to be one of the younger people in the industry at times. So it's interesting. And yes, we've got that lag in the middle as well. And again, the engagement was STEM, but it's now how do we fill those interim years where we're potentially going to have a lot of us drop off a cliff and leaving a gap behind us. But doesn't that then speak to sort of education as a whole? I mean, how much obsolescence management is taught on engineering courses, on design courses, at architectural colleges, at tech colleges?
Wasn't taught my degree. So, yeah.
When did you do yours, Alex?
It was my engineering degree was kind of generic engineering in France. That was between 2012 and 2015. And then my nuclear engineering specialization, 2015, 2016. Or no, 2014, 2015. Anyway. So yeah, not too long ago, not crazy long ago, but definitely in, you know, engineering school, that's not something that we touched on particularly.
So, I mean, if you're not educating people about this as a subject, then how do you encourage them into a career further down the line, right? Because we have the same problem.
Yeah, I mean, we have, as IOM, have recognised this. So part of our, I guess, objective is to get the next generation involved or at least aware that this is a challenge. And we are lecturing at university. There is one coming up at Sheffield University. We're very excited about this, but really it's a mindset change. And I think that next generation of engineers, they are ready for the whole sustainability movement. And as long as we are able to tie that in, that obsolescence management is one of the key things an engineer can do to enhance the sustainability of a product or their company and I guess save the planet. I think that would be a major tie-in that we could use to get that generation interested in it.
So using things like sustainability and the greening agenda as a way of raising profile would be a great way to go forward, wouldn't it?
I think so, because I think people are waking up that the circular economy is a topic they need to support to give us a planet that we can live on. And I think this is, let's call it a trend as such, that the younger generation, I think, can get on board and can get excited about it. But because let's face it, the term obsolescence management, people just cloud over. It is not a sexy topic, and we just need to make it something a bit more tangible and worthwhile investing into.
Well, I'm saying this purely as the geek in the room here, but I don't think it is an unsexy topic. It's certainly got me fired up since I started talking to John and subsequently yourself about it. But there you go. Be interesting to see what our audience thinks about it, having listened to this.
I think if I could just join in on that it is, there's been a realization both for myself and I think for the rest of IOM that actually what we've been doing for the last sort of 30 years or whatever, we were doing it as the right thing to do by obsolescence and so on. And we've suddenly realized that in actual fact, that's exactly the right thing that we need to be doing by the planet. So making things last longer, supporting things for longer, keeping them running, you know, at the top of their game for longer, you know, that's got to be, that's sustainability all over in actual fact. And do you know what? We didn't realize until a couple of years ago, I think, when the penny dropped, that actually sustainability and obsolescence management is kind of, they're coexisting. They support each other. And yeah, I think it's a great point in terms of attracting sort of future, more diverse talent into the industry.
Really interesting. Yeah. And I think, you know, this is a subject that I talk to all sorts of different professions about. And it seems to be something that we're all struggling with, is attracting that next generation, whether you work in engineering or as I do in security or in facilities. All of those professions seem to be struggling to find that hook. So maybe finding that hook and linking it in with things that are important to that generation, like sustainability, like climate change, like saving the planet, could be a really good way forward.
Definitely.
Great. Well, thank you.
Can I just come back on something that was talked about a long time ago?
Yeah, of course you can, Alex.
Just to tie it in on when your question on risk, and then Manu answered that as well. In nuclear, I think we're quite lucky that we have so many regulations to follow, because it means that we have a lot of documents to learn from and to get inspiration from. So the key ones really are from the International Atomic Energy Agency, so the IAEA, and so they have safety guides and technical report, lessons learned as well from other industries and everywhere in the world. And we have one specifically around managing aging and obsolescence on instrumentation control. But there's so many out there, so I'm sure we can put some links somewhere in the chat. But we've got different things that are proposed, and obviously the pros and cons. But if you look at replacing it with a similar equipment, for instance, so you have to look at the integrity, the reliability, performance, and how it's operated under certain conditions. But then, even though it'd be a fit form function replacement, it would still be a design change. You do have to consider that in the process. But then something that Mark mentioned around, say you've got the IP or you've got all your design documentation, you can think about remanufacturing. And even if you've got the same manufacturer, it's fine, but then you had a production that might have ceased for a long time. So then your production line is slightly different. And some expertise or documentation might be, so coming back on skills. And that will impact how you can qualify this equipment for the plant, because it is a change and we have to understand the effects. And another thing that you can do is looking at reverse engineering. So in the worst case, where you just really have to do that for very safety critical systems, for instance, then you need to make sure that you understand the operation and the functional requirements very specifically. Look at these interfaces with other systems. And it comes back to the skills. And we definitely have that in nuclear as well, where we have very senior lead engineers that have all this knowledge, and then the gap that you were talking about, John. And I think the challenge we're going to have is we're going to be competing for resources as well between all our industries. And so, yeah, we need to make it. We're trying to make nuclear very attractive and also building on that sustainability aspect and clean energy. I think that's going to be a really big challenge for everyone. And we recognize that in nuclear. There's a lot going on in that space. So, yeah.
So, I mean, Alec, this is really interesting. And you said that there are a lot of standards. You will be surprised. There's actually an obsolescence standard, the 62402, that defines, brilliant, I guess, the management of obsolescence and, I guess, the risk and how you can mitigate that risk within your own organisation.
Is that an international standard, Manu?
Yeah, correct. That's mainly driven in Europe. And then there is the DMSMS initiative that's in the US as well.
We'll make sure that we publish links to standards that are really important to people to be able to find these standards. And if they want to go and have additional reading into this subject, then we'll make sure those links are available to people.
I think it's also, if I can jump in, mentioning that there are training courses. There are actually, we have for the ION, we have certified training providers who actually provide sort of at least introductory and then go ongoing training for people who, and for corporations who are interested in actually formalizing their processes and formalizing their qualifications.
Brilliant. Thanks, John. So just one final question to wrap up this session then. And I couldn't possibly let any discussion go without introducing the two ubiquitous words that are everywhere at the moment, artificial intelligence. So artificial intelligence will just sort this out for us, right?
It could go either way, I think. You know, so if you think about, you know, what AI does in terms of a design cycle, I mean, it's going to speed up how quickly you can code things, how quickly you can, you know, turn a device. So I, my opinion, right? This is just an opinion. I don't think anybody really knows. Is that it might make the problem of obsolescence worse, because it'll speed up the life cycle of a part. Things will become obsolete faster because they'll be able to go from basically version to version a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. That's my opinion. I think it's going to make obsolescence harder.
I think it's a mixed thing. I agree with you, Mike. I think that technology triggers for obsolescence will be increased, that's for sure. However, I think there is an opportunity for an obsolescence engineer to be supported by AI when they do, let's talk maintenance plans for a machine or predictive maintenance of how soon something fails. Well, if AI is helping you with the data analysis on that side, brings it back to you, and then you as the engineer can make that decision more predictive and have less machine downtime, then that would be one of the applications of AI that helps an obsolescence engineer as such.
And I think there's a, I 100% agree, because I think it's, there are like, and so in terms of like creating devices that might functionally emulate something that has gone obsolete, I think that's another application that AI might help with as well, to quicken how quickly you can replace something and then qualify it as a replacement for that. So yeah, I think it's going to be interesting kind of how it plays out, but it's, I think it's going to be somewhat chaotic, you know?
Yeah, I think the processing of the data, you know, so there's software systems out there, and I don't think there's nobody here that particularly represents that side, but there's software systems that manage change and obsolescence in products. So the information coming back to you as a designer and a supply chain. And, you know, I think AI is going to have great benefits in terms of just its ability to sort of chunk its way through data, you know, in a way that maybe we as humans aren't quite so consistent. So I think there's good application for it there.
Yeah, my experience of AI is that it's very good at doing the heavy lifting and analysis, and as you say, John, chunking through the data, but it still very much relies on the data being there and being accurate to start with.
And being static. Yeah. I mean, so that's the problem, is as AI becomes better at analyzing, it's also going to be changing the way that things are happening. So if you're relying on historical data, it's going to be somewhat skewed. So
I'd say one thing as well about AI is the traceability. So, you know, if you asked it to do something, then you don't really know how it came up with it. So you don't have that full view of, you know, if you look at smart devices, for instance, nuclear, you have to look at the production excellence. So how they got to the product that they have, and the quality side of things. So if you start using AI to do these kind of things, then we won't be able to qualify them in the first place. But obviously, there's so many other uses of AI that we're looking at in nuclear in other aspects. But as that's one of the main issue we might have for qualifying in for our power stations.
And if you're making decisions on how to manage, maintain, and even design nuclear going forward, you have to be sure that the answers you're getting back from AI are safe.
Exactly. I think we're using AI in fusion. To, you know, I think we've asked AI once to try and manage a plasma better, and they came up with a solution that engineers didn't even think of, but it worked. So you know, for complex things like, and it, you know, fusion is slightly different from fission. Obviously, we kind of know what we're doing in fission, but there's definitely an opportunity there. Yeah, but also some risk associated. It's all about balancing the risk, isn't it, in our industries?
All about balancing the risk, Mark.
Absolutely. Balancing the risk. You know, one of the things I've been sort of thinking about as we've been, you know, talking here is, you know, we talk a lot about complex supply chains and the risk that represents. And, you know, taking, you know, using an example, just to give you an example of that. I mean, if we look at in aerospace and defense, something like the F-35 platform, you know, a fighter jet platform, has something like 1700 suppliers, direct suppliers into that program, delivering something like about 300,000 different parts. And if you broaden that out to you know, the Air Force in general, you can very quickly get to something like, you know, a million different suppliers. So how do you mitigate that risk in that supply chain of all these things that we've been talking about here? And I think it comes back to the standards, you know, coming back to driving the standards down from the end user into that supply chain. And we talked, you know, about obsolescence standards, and there's obviously other standards that relate to sourcing of electronic components and other parts, and other standards that relate to testing of those parts to make sure that we're mitigating that risk all the way through the supply chain. So I think that's a really important part. That maybe we could build on in this discussion a bit further.
And I think that's something that we'll be definitely picking up when we do part two of this podcast. So I expect to hear a lot more about that from you in part two, Mark. I'm just going to draw this one to a close for today, though, and say thank you to our panel here today. I've been absolutely fascinated. I hope everybody listening to it has been as well. This has been the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. And I'd just like to say a very, very big thank you to Mike, to Mark, to Manu, to John, and to Alex for giving us their insight. Don't forget to join us for part two of this podcast, where we'll be delving much more into supply chain, continuity, counterfeiting, and the risks that all of those bring to our businesses as well. But for now, thank you very much and goodbye. Thank you.